Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Welcome to A Life in Biography.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. We're going to be talking about your biography, The Vanishing of Carolyn Wells. Before we talk too much about the book itself, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in her.
Okay. Well, I've been actually changed jobs last year, but for the longest time I was a journalist. About 13 years I spent working as an editor at a magazine called Fine Books and Collections, which is a quarterly magazine for book collectors and booksellers and curators, kind of all about the rare and antiquarian book market. And in that job, I would very often find myself at these antiquarian book fairs. California, New York, Boston are kind of the three big ones. And in 2011, I was at the New York Antiquarian Book Fair, which is actually coming up in about a month now. It happens every April at the Park Avenue Armory. And my husband came with me that year, and he kind of tagged along with me. And while I was off talking to some booksellers, he was off buying me a surprise birthday present, which was a first edition of Henry David Thoreau's Walden. And which was a really wonderful, amazing gift. And when I opened it a few weeks later, I noticed this. It had a couple of book plates in it. Obviously, the book is 150 years old, so it's been owned by many people in the past. And one of the book plates is this really quirky, really interesting. This woman. She's kind of a Renaissance-clad woman, and she's holding in her hands this little kind of gargoyle creature called the Lincoln Imp. I would find out later, and her name is along the bottom, Carolyn Wells, and it wasn't really a name I had heard before, but I just was really interested. And it's fine. It went up on my shelf, and kind of just didn't think too much about it. Her name did stick with me because there weren't that many female book collectors in the early 20th century. So kind of stuck with me. And then after, it actually took years, years of kind of going to these antiquarian book fairs. And then I actually started to see her name on the covers of books, or the name Carolyn Wells, on the covers of these sort of Art Deco mystery novels from the 20s and 30s. And I mean, it really did take me like 7, 8 years to really put things together. That this was one and the same. And really the tip off was in 2019, or 2018, a British imprint put out a book called Murder in the Bookshop, a reprint of an old mystery called Murder in the Bookshop by Carolyn Wells. And that was probably the moment where I was like, wait a minute, it's all coming together. And I thought, considering the kind of job I had, which was, writing and editing about rare books, I thought, oh, here's my opportunity. I'm going to write an article about this woman and how she used her own knowledge of the rare book trade and buying and selling to, be the plot for this mystery novel. And it was really in the process of writing that pretty short article for a website called Crime Reads that I discovered that, not only did this woman have so many facets to her, not just mysteries and not just rare books, but that there was not very much written about her. And what I could find about her, through like Wikipedia or, places online, Poetry Foundation, it was very short, sometimes riddled with mistakes and, or sort of differing information from one website to the next. And it just kind of had a moment where I thought, wait a minute, maybe this is not an article, maybe this is a much bigger project. And that's really where it
Yeah,
started.
it sounds like an invitation to a biographer.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that there was no biography of her.
Yeah, I think that's often the case with certain subjects. The biographer discovers something and someone and realizes, well, the world has to know about this. So why does the world need to know about Carolyn Wells?
Wow, I mean, it's such a big question because, she wrote in her lifetime about 180 books. Half of them, or about 80 of them, were mystery novels, and the other 100 were children's books, young adult novels, regular adult novels, anthologies, books of crossword puzzles and brain teasers. I mean, she dabbled in just about every genre out there, and just did it just amazingly well. I mean, she just seemed to succeed. Like, once she kind of kicked her way through the door, which she did by publishing little poems and little bits of prose and humor in little magazines, and then she kind of just worked her way up to the bigger ones like Life and Harper's and The New Yorker even. She just kind of parlayed every small success into the next thing, and just created this entire like literary empire, really, from nothing. From, you know, she was just a woman, and, you know, grew up in New Jersey. She was born during the Civil War. Didn't really, there was nothing that would have suggested anything in her childhood that she was going to become this famous author. And really, she spent the first 35, even 40 years not writing, not really doing much. I mean, just, you know, not that she wasn't doing much, but she worked as a librarian in at the town library. She did not get married, and not in her youth anyway. And kind of did all of this really actually after she kind of turned 35-ish, and then she started pitching these editors. And that's actually one of the things I admire most about her, is that, she, you know, 35, 40, 45, this was kind of ancient in her time, you know, and this is when she really just gets, she just gets started.
Yeah, well, it's like Amy Lowell, one of my biographical subjects. She really doesn't, you know, start writing seriously and publishing, and, you know, until her late 30s. The interesting thing about Carolyn Wells is, just occurred to me, because she was a librarian, she was exposed to all sorts of reading material, as librarians would. What's unusual about her is that that catholicity of interest sparked a literary career, that she could work in all these different genres. I think that's one of the things that's remarkable about her, and admirable and fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she talks about, you know, being a kid and growing up in a house that was not very, very bookish. And her father actually kind of limiting what she was allowed to read. And it wasn't until she discovered the public library, probably as like a tween or an early teen, that she figured out, oh, you know, I don't need anybody's permission. I can just go there and check out books. And then when she became a librarian, she basically said that she did nothing all day except for order books and then sit there and read them.
Wonderful. That's a good education. Yeah. And a lot of writers have done that by, you know, just sort of hanging out in libraries. They're great democratic institutions in that sense.
Yeah.
It's really interesting about her. Now, you just said, you know, there wasn't all that much written about her. I mean, I'm sure there were some reviews of her books and so on, and you mentioned that in your biography. But maybe you would say, since there are, you know, quite a few biographers listening to this podcast, how you went about researching her life, and how you were able to get enough material together to write a book.
Yeah, I probably went about it all wrong. I mean, because this is my first biography, but so I kind of just, you know, it's like just kind of went everywhere at once. You know,
that's what biographers do. there's no wrong about it.
You know, when that article that I mentioned, that actually published in March of 2020. So, you know, crazy timing. And it's really over the first probably 6 months of the pandemic that I was kind of stewing on this idea of, you know, okay, so there could be something else here. There's so much about her, but there's nothing written about her, you know, biography, and what is out there is kind of riddled with weird errors. So I just kind of was stewing on this idea, and it came in various forms. I mean, at the beginning, I was like, wait, what if I ordered, you know, a copy of every single one of her books, 180 plus books, and I just read them in order, and I did some kind of book about that. You know, like, I had some crazy ideas at the beginning, but then I just started mostly writing away to universities and colleges, like university libraries. And, you know, if I find a letter that they had, or, you know, I find through WorldCat or Archive Space, oh, they've got a handful of letters or they've got a box, I'd write away to them and say, well, what do you have specifically and can I get copies of it? And it started with that. I wrote away immediately to the Rahway Public Library, that's where she was a librarian, and kind of asked if they had any archival material, any books, and they put me in touch with the town historian who was very helpful. They don't really have very much in terms of archives, but you know, he said, well, come visit us and you can see what we do have. And I can take you to see her old house and I can take you to her grave. And so it kind of started making little field trips. And by sleuthing around in some like genealogy, and I found a woman who is her great niece, who's still alive. She's in her late 80s. And this was another moment where I was like, okay, maybe the family members have like, you know, an attic full of her stuff. And they don't, but they did have a few things. And so this great niece, Phyllis, and I, we became kind of pen pals. And I've been to visit her several times to see what she has. Namely, she has this great scrapbook that Carolyn kept during her life, that she had all of her famous artists and author friends sign and make art in. Really amazing scrapbook. So, I mean, to call it a scrapbook.
That's a treasure.
Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible piece of history, and I'm so glad that the family held on to it, because there was a question of like, you know, where did this thing ever end up? So really I just kind of, I don't know, started doing research in newspapers.com. That was hugely helpful because, you know, she wrote all these books, and so there were definitely reviews of most of her books, and you know, you could kind of go through and not just get the New York Times or, you know, the Times of London, because you want to see what other people were thinking too. And so the newspapers.com really helped me with that. When I was researching the films, the silent films, I kind of had to reach out to silent film scholars and the Library of Congress and, you know, try to see if any of the films that she worked on was going to be anything I could watch or screen or anything. But yeah, kind of just went in 100 different directions.
Well, yeah, one of the nice things about your book, one of the most engaging things about your book is that your book has a real voice, your voice. And you include the reader as almost a kind of ally in your search for things. And you share some of your frustrations and some of your discoveries so that it becomes what I said in the New York Sun, you know, I consider it sort of what you might call a process biography. And I think that makes it all the more intriguing.
Yeah, I had never really heard that phrase. And when I read it, the minute I read it, I was like, that is exactly right. That's exactly the perfect phrase for what this is. Yeah, I don't know. I've mentioned before that, you know, I was kind of inspired by a woman named Mallory O'Meara, who wrote a book called The Lady from the Black Lagoon. I don't know if you read this book. It came out a few years ago. Yeah, it's a little bit, it's a similar kind of vibe of a book, which is like, it's a biography, but it's not really a cradle to grave kind of biography. And she's in it in the way that I'm sort of in Carolyn's biography. And she kind of goes through similar motions, and she does get to a descendant who has, you know, sort of the proverbial attic full of stuff. And so she gets that. And she is doing the same thing. She's reviving the legacy of a woman who worked in early Hollywood, who created the creature from the Black Lagoon and other, you know, creatures and special effects, and then was entirely erased from the history of that. And so I was really inspired by that, by her approach. And I guess in some ways I was also inspired by Carolyn, who, you know, basically she wrote an autobiography, and she said, you know, pointedly, I don't like autobiography. I don't like biography. I don't like memoir. I don't like any of these things because I don't think they're truthful. And also they can be rather boring. And I thought, you know, I want to amuse, I want to sort of entertain, which is, you know, Carolyn was a very witty and light. I mean, that's how she really kind of projected herself to the world, as this woman who didn't work too hard. Everything came easily. Everything was amusing. And so I kind of took that too and thought, like, I want this biography to be something that's entertaining and amusing, even though you're going to learn a lesson. and even though my whole reason for doing it is to just kind of bring her back into the spotlight a little bit. So I don't know, and I did know while I was writing that there were going to be readers who liked that approach and readers who just absolutely don't like that approach.
Yeah, you also do what another term for your book might be called a virtue of necessity biography. That is, you deal with a figure about whom it's difficult finding some of the information. You know, there aren't six archives that have all this information about the writer, and so you make it a quest narrative.
Yeah,
and I think people can really identify with that. You know, when they're doing the genealogy of their own families, and there are gaps in the research and things like that. I think that there's a famous biography, Quest for Corvo. And it's about, again, a biographical subject about whom it's difficult to know, to find information, but even to figure out, well, what's really true, because the subject is such a fabulist, making up so many things that the biographer has to be, you know, careful, a kind of detective, to figure out those things.
Yeah. Well, with Carolyn,
so
you know.
Yeah, go
sorry.
Ahead.
I was going to say, with Carolyn, you know, even in the early research, and even today, I'll still see this circulated, that she was married to the heir of the Houghton Mifflin publishing firm, which is untrue. She did marry later in life. She married at the age of 55, and she did marry a man named Hadwin Houghton, who was, you know, related to, obviously, the Houghton family of Cambridge, Massachusetts, that had a publishing firm. But he did not work in publishing, and he was certainly not the heir to the fortune of that. So that, to me, it's like it's one of these facts, quote unquote facts, that gets, you know, circulated and regurgitated over and over again, and it's just not true. And not only is it not true, I kind of worry that, you know, that was put out there to make it seem as if, well, she only got published so much because her husband was the, you know, the heir to the firm, you know, like another way of trying to put her down.
Sure. Yeah, no, I can see that. You mentioned that just about half her output is mystery stories, and she has this detective. I think you should talk about a little bit, maybe Fleming Stone, because Wells was a reader of detective fiction. I'm no expert on her detective fiction. I've read exactly one of her mysteries, The Clue, which is the first one, first in book form. Which I quite enjoyed.
Yeah, I enjoyed that one too. Yeah, well, she, you know, so that one was published in 1909, and you know, her last was published actually after her death, 1942. And in between those two dates, she published 82 mystery novels. So extreme output. And again, as I was saying before, you know, that first one that was published in 1909, The Clue, she was 47 years old when that was published, and that's the first of 82 more. So yeah, I think, you know, in the beginning, she focused on what was a popular version of the mystery at the time, which was this clue puzzler, this like how done it, very little in terms of characters or motivation, which is would become popular in another decade or two down the line. And it's fair to say that she did not kind of move with the times. She kept doing what she was doing at the beginning. And, you know, she had a great following for that. I mean, obviously, she was not only writing and publishing three or four mysteries a year at some points, even five at some years, but selling really well, 13,000 copies on average for each, which at the time is a lot. And it's a lot today. And libraries loved her. I mean, she was just, you know, very well circulated in the libraries and translated and, you know, being published in other countries. I mean, she really did have this huge following. And so it's like one of the reasons we're coming back to that question before, like, why write a biography of her? And it's like, how does a woman who wrote all of this and was so popular, I mean, really a bestseller, some of the books to films, how is it somebody that I've never heard of, you know, like that to me just didn't, there was just to me a disconnect there.
So she dies in 1942.
Yeah.
And as you say in the biography, that's before the what might be called the paperback revolution.
Yeah.
And yeah. Her work is not part of that.
Right. I mean, of the 82 mysteries, I've only been able to find 3 paperback editions. And I don't even know that they were licensed editions. I mean, the paperback boom is just getting underway at that time. She dies in 1942. And, you know, one of the things I come to learn in this biography is that she left almost everything, including her copyrights, to her maid, a woman who took care of her for the last, you know, 2 decades of her life. Which is, you know, wonderful. And it really kind of set this woman up. She ended up being able to move out of the city and move her family out of the city and probably had a much better life, but was not in a position to go to publishers and demand you keep the books in print or, you know, why don't you put them in this newfangled paperback format? That just didn't happen. And it's really because of that. I mean, that's one of the main factors in why we don't know Carolyn's name today, why she wasn't really kept in the public eye, because, you know, once your books are not on the shelf at the bookstore anymore, and then once, you know, the library weeds them out after maybe 10 or 15 years of use, that's it. I mean, how does somebody find you otherwise?
Yeah, and there's no literary, there's a literary executor in a sense, but there isn't one that's literary that's going to have any sense of the market or the possibility of perpetuating the writer's name and the writer's work.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually surprising because she did work for Carolyn for about 2 decades, but again, just, you know, was maybe just not savvy enough, or maybe just didn't care. I don't know, but just didn't bother following that in any sense.
Well, yeah, the literary world is its own world. And those outside of that world really have no feeling for it. So we don't know very much about the relationship between the maid and Carolyn. But it certainly looks like, from the outside anyway, the maid probably wasn't. I mean, I've known this, discovered this in dealing with literary figures. I'll interview members of their family, and some of them barely have any grasp at all of what their famous relative did as a writer, or even care. And that's simply because literature is not part of their world. It's not a part of what's important to them. And often that's the case, even when they're related to that person. So in that sense, I'm not all that surprised, since Carolyn didn't, you know, have children. And even when these literary figures have children, that's not any guarantee in terms of being remembered by posterity. So it sort of makes sense. And there's a kind of like a concatenation of events here, where she doesn't have a defined literary estate. She doesn't have an executor who's proactive. The publishers, I'm not sure why, don't try to revive her. Do they think maybe she's passé or dated? I don't know.
I could see that being the case. You know, as I said before, she didn't really move with the times when it came to the style of the mystery book, which was, you know,
I can't speak for the other I can't speak for the other mysteries, but the clue, you know, it held my attention. There was enough characterization in there. There's certainly not depth of characterization in that kind of novel, but there was enough for me to keep me going. And I wanted you to say just a little bit more about Fleming Stone, and where does he fit in? Is he a Sherlock Holmes kind of figure? What kind of a detective would you say he is?
Yeah, I think he's meant to be that. And she loved Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, you know, when she would think about or talk about the people who inspired her most, it was Arthur Conan Doyle and Anna Katharine Green, who's considered sort of the mother of American detective fiction. I do think Fleming Stone was meant to be it's meant to be a Sherlock Holmes knockoff. And in the beginning, reviewers would say that all the time. Even in the films that got made based on some of her early mysteries, it was always, you know, oh, America has its own Sherlock Holmes now. I mean, that was that was what she was aiming for. Unfortunately, Fleming Stone is just, he's not really as quite as interesting as Sherlock. Fleming Stone is not quite as interesting as Sherlock Holmes. He's scholarly, he's a little plodding. And in many of the novels, he kind of swoops in toward the end, you know, so he's not really for the whole novel. So maybe that's the difference. You don't really get to see him at work necessarily. He kind of swoops in sometimes in the last like 30 pages of the book. I mean, really, she waits a long amount of time to, you know, for the characters to say, you know, like, oh, okay, nothing is working. Maybe we should call in Fleming Stone now. So you don't have enough time with him, maybe. It's part of the problem.
It's kind of fun, though, I think, because in a sense, the other characters do some of his work for him. Yeah. And then he's got to come in and put together the pieces.
Yeah. I know, it's funny. The characters work as like little detectives in many of the novels, especially these sort of country house. You know, you've got a country house, something happens, and you've six or eight people, and they are all, you know, trying to figure it out and blaming each other. And then they have to call him in. But
one of the things that concerns everybody who's thinking about writing a biography or has a biography is getting a publisher. Was that hard for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was in terms of her being an unknowable factor. You know, I wrote a pretty substantial proposal, and I wrote the entire chapter on her film work. That was kind of the easiest chapter to start out with, particularly during the pandemic when I wasn't able to necessarily travel anywhere and I did a lot of the research online. So I had, you know, an entire proposal and that whole chapter. And I got a little pushback from both agents and publishers with, well, how are you possibly going to write a book about someone, you know, if there's no archives out there, no sort of central archive, place where you're going to go and all the information is going to be there. They didn't quite grasp the whole, you know, but I'm going to seek it out. I'm going to search for it. And that's going to be part of the story. And then, I mean, I did get a little pushback in terms of, well, nobody knows her. And, you know, maybe this whole, I don't want to call it a trope, but maybe this whole, you know, subject matter of like reviving a woman's legacy, like maybe I've already read that five times already in the last decade. So, which, you know, it was hard to hear. So
you're dealing with a lot of jaded people, you know, a lot of jaded people who can't see beyond what's out there already.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's one publisher who said, well, it sounds like a fantastic idea and I wish you all the luck in the world, but I don't think you're ever going to sell more than 10 copies of this book.
But,
you know, and it's, I guess I felt so strongly that I kind of just let most of that just roll off my back because I thought, well, that's fine if that's how you feel, but I still think that she absolutely deserves to have a biography and, you know, and I think I could do it well. I mean, so I felt so strongly and I still feel strongly that, you know, she's a really interesting character in women's history and literary history. I don't know.
She's funny.
She's funny. Oh yeah. I mean, I love some of her phrases and her letters when she writes to an editor and she says, and she's basically pitching herself for a job. And she says, you know, a bright woman is better than a dull man and much cheaper. I mean, it's just a fantastic quote and, you know, totally. And she wasn't necessarily pushy about it, but she would just write these little phrases and very much like take it or leave it. She would write to editors even at the beginning of her career when she wasn't a known quantity and just say, well, here's this poem and, you know, let me know if you want it quickly, because if you don't, you know, I'll just send it to the next person on the list, you know, which is like funny that she would think to herself, you know, that it's okay to kind of correspond with these editors of these major magazines and just say, I'll move on to the next place.
She kept going in spite of rejections, as you did.
Yeah.
So how did you wind up at Post Hill Press?
Well, I mean, I you know, I landed an agent after, you know, I don't think it was too many submissions before I found an agent. And I was happy to find agents who were really behind me in terms of like, this is a great idea, regardless of if people haven't heard of her. you know, Debbie Englander at Post Hill Press is another person who was like, well, this is a great idea. I mean, there are certainly, you know, naysayers who may say that it's not necessarily a saleable idea in terms of, you know, we're not going to sell tens of thousands of copies of this, not going to be a bestseller, but it is, it's a good idea and it's worth doing. So I was lucky to find both an agent and a publisher who felt that same way.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good story. And an agent used to say to me, you know, it only takes one, didn't matter how many rejections there were. And the other thing I would say, which you've probably learned too, is in spite of how much experience publishers might have and experts and so on, they don't really know. If they knew, they'd be a lot wealthier and publishing would be a lot healthier if they actually knew what the market was. They think they know what the market is. They think they know what the trend is. They think something's already been done. And then something comes out and it just proves them all wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I was hoping that this is one of those cases.
So are you going to do another biography or has this thoroughly exhausted you?
I think I would do another biography, actually. I really liked the process. I mean, I love research. I love kind of tracking something down and you know, even if I have to go to the ends of the earth to get it.
Yes.
So I really like that process. So I could absolutely see myself doing another one. I wrote a book 9 years ago. It was about rare books, which is, again, what my beat was at the time. And this, you know, between that book and this book is 9 years. So I hope it's not that far of a stretch again.
Yeah. Don't keep us waiting too long.
Yeah. Come up with a good topic and whether it will be in the same arena or somewhere else. I was going to say, I didn't really come into this as like a mystery lover. I mean, that's certainly not, you know, I came at it more of sort of a book collector than a mystery lover. So, you know, I think that Mary Roberts Rinehart is, you know, she was one of Carolyn's biggest kind of competitors in that market at the time, the mystery, best-selling mystery market. I think she's kind of deserving of a refreshed biography as well.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I haven't looked to see what's been done on her, but she would be, I think, a really prime candidate. If I have this right, her son went into publishing, was a Reinhardt, a whole Reinhardt and Winston at one time. And I think Mary Roberts Rinehart was his mother. So there are a lot of things there to be said, I think, about her. The evolution of the publishing industry, all kinds of things. So she would be a really good subject, I think. Yeah. So something to think about, maybe to grab.
Yeah.
I think it's a possibility. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. What I'm going to do is post podcast and you can post it anywhere you like too.
Okay, great.
For anyone who hasn't, I should say too that I did review your book in the New York Sun, I thought it was wonderful, and I'm really happy I had the opportunity.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
Okay, and I'm sure hoping that you do another biography.
Thank you. I'll let you know when I have a good idea.
Okay, great. Thanks, Rebecca.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.